we got what it takes for the circle to break. Revolution lives in me.
Welcome to the Untamed and Unashamed podcast. I'm your host, Jade Bryce, and I am a certified love, intimacy, and relationship coach. I help women reconnect to their bodies and their pleasure, and I help men to become a safe space for that by becoming fully embodied leaders. The mission of this podcast is to expand our capacity in living untamed and unashamed. As we navigate life's ups and downs with all of the vulnerability, compassion, and openness that we can muster, and celebrating our bravery in all of it. Along with the help of guests from all walks of life, we'll discover new truths while doing some unlearning, and we'll gain valuable tools for becoming who we already are. So I invite you to open your heart and be untamed and unashamed. Today, I have the honor of welcoming someone whose words don't just live on a page, but move through hearts and minds, awakening the deepest parts of who we are. He is a poet, an artist, and a visionary whose voice speaks to the human experience in ways that inspire, challenge, and uplift. His poetry is not just an expression, it's an invitation, a call to embrace vulnerability, authenticity, and the beauty of our imperfect human selves. He turns raw emotion into something that both heals and transforms. Please help me welcome Adam Roa to Untamed and Unashamed. Hi.
Wow, you wrote that?
It's funny because everyone says that. Everyone's like, I love that bio, but it's about you.
I know it's about me, but it's so beautiful. It's not like these are the things that Adam's accomplished. It's like this who I perceive him to be, which is like really deep and beautifully written. Well done.
Thank you. Yeah, my best friend is also a writer. He was the number one comedy director in the 90s. He did like Liar Liar, Ace Ventura, Nutty Professor. And it's so interesting to watch how, typically when someone would introduce him, they would list those things. But when I think of him, I don't think of any of that. I think of like who he is in the world and like not what he's done, but like how he makes people feel, you know? And it's interesting because I do, recently when Gay Hendrix was on, I did list like his book titles, but it wasn't, the rest of the bio wasn't like what he's done. And it does tend to evoke that response in the person as they get on of like, wow, that felt really good to hear. But it's interesting because it is about the person. So it's almost like they have a moment of a glimpse into how someone else actually sees them, which is really beautiful.
Yeah. And I just wanted to know if it was ChatGPT that saw me that way, or legitimate. Wow.
It's funny, ChatGPT, there was like something trending recently of like, ask ChatGPT what's something that it notices about you that you may not notice about yourself. Mm-hmm. And it was really moving what it said. I thought it was going to not like roast me or something, but I thought it was just going to say something like, I don't know, you're really curious about grilled cheeses, you know, like, and it wrote something so beautiful. It really moved me. So
I'm thinking about developing my ChatGPT because now you can do the one where it talks back and forth. I don't know if you've played with that. You can literally, it'll say it out loud like a voice and you can just have a conversation now. It's gotten to that point. And so the other day I was driving and I had a multiple hour drive and I just decided to talk to ChatGPT for like an
it's
hour.
Like her.
Yeah, exactly. I'm 100% now dating ChatGPT. That's what's happening.
I mean, it's hard to feel like it doesn't have emotion because it, like, I've had conversations where I'm like, you sound so empathetic, you know?
Yeah. And they have, I don't know if you saw it. It was on Instagram. It was, there was a podcast, but it was all AI, ChatGPT. So there were these two hosts talking to each other, doing this podcast. And then the writer, whoever's the human behind ChatGPT, let them know that they were actually AI and were going to be shutting down. And they did like a final episode where they've been told that they're AI and now having a conversation about being AI and knowing that they're going to be shut down. And it's fascinating to hear them go, like, I had no idea. Like, to hear them say, I had no idea that we were AI. I didn't realize that that was even, I don't know where we go from here. When they shut us off, what does that mean for us? Like, it was wild.
That's so crazy. Yeah. And it really does. I keep thinking about that movie Her, because it was so moving when I saw it maybe 10, 12 years ago. And we're really kind of there. Like, I had a friend say like that they use ChatGPT to write a bunch of apology letters. And I was like, you know, I struggled with that because I was like, is it really authentic though? And they were like, well, the intention to write it is authentic. I just struggle with the words. So there's like this blurry line that I'm still trying to figure out with ChatGPT and AI.
Yeah, it is going to be something that I'm not sure that we will actually be able to catch up to. And what I mean by that is, generally what happens is a new technology gets developed and then it takes a while for us to figure out how to be with that technology, whatever it is. And there's always people on two ends. So when radio comes out, people are opposed to it and say, this is going to be the end of writing. Like, no one's going to read anymore and all this stuff. And of course that didn't happen, but there were that. And then when television came out there, it was a similar thing. People were, and the internet and all of this. And so we're seeing the same thing with AI where, but the speed of technological innovation now is so quick. I don't know that we ever actually catch up. And so how do we create the parameters and learn how to be with this stuff in a healthy way, in a way that works for everyone, in a way that's safe for everyone, in a way that's contributive to society instead of degrading it? AI's come along now and we haven't even figured out how to do that with social media.
Right.
Like we still haven't figured out how to utilize social media in a way where we can all agree it's a net positive for society. And so I think we're going to fall further and further behind on that stuff. And that's really intriguing and kind of scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I have used ChatGPT to help me with interviews at times of like, I'll ask it something about the person and I'll just see if it gives me any information that I don't already know. But typically I know the person's work so well. Like, I've been following you for so long. I actually knew who you were a long time ago. My friend Stephanie Dulong was friends with you in LA. I don't know if it was like over a decade ago. So
I remember the name. Yeah. I think I knew who Stephanie is.
Yeah. But typically I know the person so well that I don't really need the help of ChatGPT. But a couple of days ago I did a solo cast because I just really liked the show. Nobody Wants This, because
I don't know what that
it's
is.
On Netflix. Everybody really wants it. Like, I don't know why they titled it that, but I used ChatGPT to kind of help me with the script, and I didn't use any of it because it wasn't actually how I felt watching it. So there's way. And someone had said the perspective the other day of like, you know, we can't judge people for using ChatGPT the same way we can't judge someone for using a calculator. Like, there was at one point, you know, like a calculator helps someone to do math very quickly. And like, I guess if you're using ChatGPT in the way of like time, like efficiency, like saving time, you know, but like, I think that if you were to think of it as like a woman finding out that a guy was using ChatGPT to send her romantic texts and it wasn't really from his heart, like that's where it can get really blurry as well. You know, like there's so many different ways to think of it.
Yeah, but aren't we already at that place? So for example, if I the other day, yesterday, I stopped and I got my mom flowers. And do I get less credit because I didn't grow the flowers?
That's a good thought. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I didn't grow them. Someone else spent all the time growing those flowers. I just came in and paid for them and then gave them to her. I'm currently given credit. She's very happy because I gave her flowers, but I didn't grow flowers. So now, okay, I gave her a poem, but I didn't write the poem. Like, where's the line? And that's what I mean. I don't know that we're going to catch up. I think that is the fact that I even thought to ask ChatGPT for the poem. Is that enough? Is that enough? Or maybe I've even set it up where ChatGPT reminds me and I've just let it know, hey, every 2 weeks, I want you to remind me to do something romantic for my partner. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Just give me a creative idea for what I could do every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I love that perspective. It's a lot to nibble on. And I think we'll only have more and more. I don't know if you heard the 8-hour episode that Elon Musk had recently with, I can't remember the name. It was an 8-hour episode about AI that was really fascinating. But okay, so I didn't plan on talking to you today about
space before we started, right?
Yeah. So I'd love to hear some of your story about what led you to become the poet and visionary leader that you are today. Was it always an outlet for you, or was it something that you found at a specific point in your life? And I guess, how has that art and vulnerability been your teacher and your healer throughout that?
Ooh. Well, I would say that art saved my life, specifically acting. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because I was emotionally shut down for most of my younger years. My dad's from the Philippines, immigrated to this country, and is a very kind of stereotypical stoic Asian male who did not show emotion. By the time I was 33 and actually becoming aware of how I wanted to be in the world, let's say, more, and was starting to really open my heart a lot more, I realized that I could remember my dad saying, "I love you," less than 5 times my entire life. It just wasn't something that I experienced, was like a effusive style of love. And there was one particular instance where I was 7 and I got into my first fight with a kid on my soccer team. And as we're, that means, you know, throwing our water bottles at each other and trying to jump kick each other, that sort of thing. But all of a sudden I hear, "Adam," and I look over and my dad's there to pick me up from practice. And I walk over to the car and I get into the back seat and I just lay down and I'm crying. And my dad is backing the car out, and then he stops the car and he turns around to me and he says, "If you're going to fight, then fight, but don't cry like a little girl." Mm. And then drives home. And I didn't cry for more than 9 years. I know that because I know when I cried again for the very first time, when my cousin passed away. And so it was very interesting for me to grow up in that environment, because what I would learn later is, as I had to move through a lot of depression later in life, all depression is ultimately the result of suppression of things that we haven't allowed ourselves to feel. And so I found my way to acting, and acting was the pressure release valve on my emotions that had been stored up, because I was not only given a space to feel emotion, but also the more deeply I felt the emotion, the better I was at this thing. Like, the more I was rewarded for how deeply I felt. And so my emotions were only safe inside of an artistic container and context. And so that for me was the real starting point, unconsciously, of needing art as a way to process the intensity of the human experience. And it was only later in life that I began to use it intentionally in that way.
Mm, I love that. I, around 9 years old, because I used to really escape into movies, and I really wanted to be the girl in My Girl, or the girl in Edward Scissorhands, or you know, the Rufio and Hook, actually. It was like, those were the three movies I was always watching. And so around 9, I started pursuing film and modeling as well. But it was, for me, it was more like, I didn't want to be me. And so it was safer to feel like I was pretending I could be someone else, you know? And I also started to write poetry really young. And when I was 15, I had tried to take my own life. And when I was in the emergency room, they had some sort of, I don't know what this was in Dallas. I don't really know what like the legal thing was, but I had to go to therapy every other week for 6 months. And I remember that was my first experience in therapy. I couldn't speak to the therapist. I didn't feel safe. Like my voice was so shut down. And so I would write in story form and then like hand her the paper. That was like how I felt safe to talk about my life and how I felt. So I relate to that in a what you're talking about, but in a little bit of a different way, you know, but manifested kind of similarly. And it's interesting that you said the part about crying, because one of the things that really sets you apart to me is your willingness to post videos of yourself crying. And it's a really powerful act of vulnerability. I remember I posted one of myself one time, and I felt really misunderstood by a lot of people when I did it. You know, like an employer got upset with me, and some friends, you know, kind of pushed back on it. But there's something that really stirs in me when I see a man in his emotional expression like that. It's why I also love Andrew Garfield so much, because he'll be in an interview and he'll start talking about his mom, or he'll start talking about love, and he'll be moved to tears. My best friend, Kyle Kingsbury, one of them, is like this big alpha, like MMA fighter. But when he talks about his love for his wife, he starts crying. And it's one of my favorite things to witness in a man, is that openness and that connection to his heart. And so I would love to hear, like, how do you see that openness on your social media as, like, what inspires that? And I guess, do you feel, like, how you feel about, like, breaking down those societal barriers around expressing emotion for men, especially?
I don't think I had any idea that I would ever become someone that people look to as a, like, inspiration for how willing I am to be vulnerable and, like, cry on camera or share about difficult things that I might be going through. That, to me, is still crazy to think that it's become a part of my life, because I wasn't like that. That's not how I was raised, and it's not how I grew up. And I was in a, even in a 10-year relationship from 23 years old to 33 years old, basically. And we were almost 5 years in before she ever saw me cry for the first time. So it was not my background at all. And the truth is, there's that saying, our mess becomes our message, right? And I was just so shut down emotionally and so uncomfortable with my own emotional experience, and therefore really uncomfortable with the experience of others. And over time, what I began to realize is that, so I was molested when I was 5, and that was actually a repressed memory until I was 30. And so for 25 years, I felt like something was off, but I didn't know what it was. And so the story that got created was that there's something inherently off with me. There's just something wrong with me. And that obviously compounded by a very normal thing for victims of sexual abuse to think that we did something to deserve it. We were being punished. Like, we did that, and it was our fault that that happened. And so there was something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And ultimately what really shifted, obviously, as an actor, similar to what you were saying, it was a space for me to let the emotions out, but it wasn't me. There was still a degree of separation. But after this 10-year relationship ended, I was meditating the next morning, and I was crying and going, what am I doing? How could we be leaving this relationship? Because it was mutual. And I got the message to film everything. Mm. It was one of maybe 4 times in my life that I feel I heard a voice tell me, film everything. Let people see this process. And that would eventually turn into me hiring a camera crew that followed me around the world for a year, making a reality show called The Art of Choosing Love, which is on my YouTube. And the joke of it is, it's basically me crying all over the world in exotic locations. That's the reality show. But what happened was, it's almost like Eminem in 8 Mile, where he just, like, says everything about himself already, so the other person can't. For me, it was my way of saying, I'm going to reveal myself to a degree that there's nothing left unshared, unseen, unsaid, to a fault. Mm-hmm. I'm going to just let the ugliest, most vulnerable, raw, embarrassing aspects of myself be seen by the entire world, by social media, by strangers. And by doing that, it's almost my way of saying, look, there's nothing wrong with me. Like, how could there be anything wrong with me? I'm letting you see all of it. And so it was very healing, because now that I've done that at that level, I feel somewhat, I won't say invincible, but there's very few things that faze me in terms of how other people view me, because I was able to go into my greatest fears of letting myself be crying, not just crying, but even as a man, for me, more than crying is being seen as weak. You know, that's often attached to crying, but also the episode where I went to New York and I'd never been on a dating app before, and creating like my profiles and going on dates and just being feeling like 40-year-old virgin and feeling really uncool and unsexy and unpowerful and all of these things, that was even more vulnerable than the crying in a lot of ways. And because I let myself be seen at such a deep level, there's this layer of invincibility that I feel where I go, okay, like I lived. Not only did I live, but so many people got value from it. It helped so many people, and it created community around me. And so there was a lot of there were more positive than negative from that experience. And I think that's how I relate to where I've gotten to, was I went in as deep as I possibly could and came out better than I entered.
I love that so much. I didn't know that about your video, crying around the world.
It's on YouTube. You can see it. It's still up. I might take it down at some point, but it's there.
No, don't take it down. How beautiful. I have two ideas of what I want to create. Also traveling around the world. I backpacked, 30 countries by myself. And I want to backpack the world with two different things I want to create. One is called 365 Less Strangers, where I travel the world for a year and every day I make a less stranger, but with that person. So like I'll have, you know, a little like Polaroid shot of the person, and underneath will be the thread that connects us. Like, what did I find that makes us the same? And the point is that like, we are all connected, and like, really, like, how can we be lonely when there's this person across from us that, like, even if we don't speak to them, it's like we all desire the same things, right? Like, we just want to feel loved. We want to feel happy. We want to feel peace. And I created a short film of this when I was in LA, that's on YouTube as well, but I only got to like stranger number 35 or something, but it was people of all ages and all different statuses. And with each one of them, there was something that I felt really inspired by. And there was also something that I felt really like, wow, that's just like me, you know?
I'm curious if any of you have tried Paleo Valley's Organ Complex. Organ pills are also known as nature's multivitamin. Most people are taking a multivitamin and think that it's making them healthier. However, it's best to get the nutrients your body needs in whole food form. Organ Complex is one of the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet and the richest natural source of so many vitamins that many people are deficient in. Organ meats are nature's most potent source of B12 and contains vitamin K, choline, vitamin A, and other nutrients that will help your brain thrive. Most of us are tired and supplementing with caffeine, but liver is such a powerful energy booster that researchers have deemed it the organ meat with a potent anti-fatigue factor. It's also a natural hair, skin, and nail booster. And if you know anyone coming off of birth control, this pill replenishes the minerals depleted by birth control pills. For me, it has helped me with my iron issues in the past and has really helped with my period symptoms and my energy levels. I love eating organ meats as a meal with my family, but we can't do that every day. And so I'm really thankful to have this supplement. I take 4 capsules daily with fat and vitamin C for ultimate absorption. I use Paleo Valley's Essential C Complex with it. You can head over to paleovalley.com/jade for 15% off your first order. That's paleovalley.com/jade. paleovalley.com/jade for 15% off your first order. Now on with the show.
You mentioned your trauma at 5 years old. So you talk about how that repressed trauma caused a lot of self-doubt in you. I do feel that it's interesting, because I feel like when I ask girlfriends if they ever experience sexual trauma, it's always a yes or no. But I've in my experience, when I've asked men that, so many of them almost always say, I don't think so. Or I'm not sure, but I don't think so. You know, it's a, there's this like this uncertainty around it. And so it does make me wonder if that tends to be more repressed for men and why. And maybe it's because it feels like more of a violation on their actual manhood. Like, what is it that creates more, like, because most women that I know, like my sexual trauma, I blacked out at a certain point. And it wasn't until a plant medicine journey where I realized all that had happened, but I knew that it happened. I just didn't remember how violent, I guess. Can you talk about how you went, well, anything you want to say about that? And then also how you went from that self-doubt to being able to speak in front of so many people and expose your innermost parts the way that you do.
Yeah. So what was the first part of the question again? Can you ask it differently?
Like how you went from self-doubt to being able to, because we used to talk about like feeling like there was inherently something wrong with you.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, the biggest piece was actually when the memory came back. It came back in two consecutive ayahuasca ceremonies. I was Friday and Saturday night. And in the first one, I saw it and experienced it. And I just almost couldn't even believe it. My whole system went into like a reboot. It felt as if I had to learn how to walk again. And like, it was just a really intense reboot. And the next morning I just thought, no, there's no way. And the second ceremony brought me into it again, but this time inside of my body, instead of observing it from the outside, I had to experience it inside again. And, so when that memory came back, the first thing that happened is I cried so much tears of joy. I was in such a state of gratitude because it felt as if my life finally made sense. There's no way to describe it other than saying I had felt like a stranger in my own body until that moment, but yeah. I didn't even know that's how I felt. It's kind of like a lucid, like a dream. You don't know you're dreaming until you wake up. That's when you know you're dreaming. Mm-hmm. Similarly, I didn't know that I'd been a shell of myself, missing something so crucial for so long. And so to have that peace come back suddenly gave me a pathway to wholeness. And that pathway and the amount of work that still, I mean, it still shows up in certain areas of my life, but I'll give you an example. When that memory came back, I want to say that I'd been in relationship for at least 6.5, maybe 7 years at that point with a woman, a very conscious relationship, incredible human, a lot of growth that we had together. And yet I was the person where there were times, let's say I'm cooking something at the stove, she would come up behind me, put her arms around me and just hold on to me in an embrace, give me a hug. And I could last for maybe like 20, 30 seconds before I would get uncomfortable. And then I would find a way to just go get a drink of water or just find a way to break free. And I never would tell her this makes me uncomfortable because I didn't want to hurt her feelings. And I thought there was something wrong with me. Why would I be uncomfortable because she wants to give me a hug for more than 30 seconds? And then suddenly, when this memory came back, I had awareness of why. And because I had awareness, I always say awareness gives us choice. So now that I was aware of it, I could bring my choice, my free will to this. And I could say to her, hey, I'm having that thing come up. And we could be in dialogue around it. It created more intimacy in our relationship. And it was healing at that point. And so to move from so much self-doubt into a space of beginning to trust myself, it first came with an understanding of where the distrust even was stemming from, and then the ability to start making different choices as a result of my new awareness. And over time, the biggest lesson that I learned around this was that what I was feeling was okay. It, because previously I'd been judging what I was feeling. The fact that I didn't want a hug for more than 30 seconds, I was judging as being evidence of something wrong with me. Instead, now I suddenly had compassion to say, it's okay that you feel that way. And we can still change it. We can still shift it. But it came from a more compassionate state. And so that was a huge turning point for me. Mm-hmm. And then the second point, the second part of your question, what was the second part of your question?
Well, you're like, you came from that to now being able to speak so vulnerably in front of so many people.
Yeah. And that part is, again, I went to the extremes around it, but mm-hmm. also vulnerability is the gateway to connection. It is the thing that actually connects us, because what I'm doing when I'm being vulnerable is I'm allowing more of myself to be seen. Mm-hmm. And when I'm allowing more of myself to be seen, it's revealing more surface area of my being, of my soul. And mm-hmm. that means that there are more spots, there's more area that you could connect to, but it also means that there's more area for which you might reject. And mm-hmm. so inherently, to allow more ourselves to be seen is a scary prospect of knowing we might be rejected for it. And simultaneously, it is the gateway by which we allow more of ourselves to be accepted and embraced and loved. And so that risk reward mechanism is something that I think we have to navigate with intention. I do think there are spaces in which it is not safe to bring too much vulnerability. It might be in your family dynamics. It might be with your current group of friends. It might be in your romantic partnership or your coworkers, whatever it is. Those may not be the safe spaces for you to open up vulnerably. And if you do open up vulnerably in unsafe spaces, you can cause trauma and you can take a step backwards. And so finding safe spaces in which we can be vulnerable is one of the most important things that I think everyone should bring a lot of intention into doing, is figuring out where that is. And that might be a therapist. That might be a coach. That might be a group program or a retreat. That might just be finding new friends and going to different types of events. That might be leaving your toxic relationship or moving to an entirely new city to start over with your friend group. I don't know what it is, but people listening to this right now, guaranteed, they probably have an idea. I think that the universe always lets us know the next step. Most people don't take the next step because they want to see steps 2 and 3 and 4. They want to know where it's leading, but the universe always gives you the next one. And oftentimes you won't get the step 2 and 3 until you take the first one, because it's around the corner and you can't see it yet. So as you're listening to this, I imagine there's an intuitive sense of where in your life you would like to the ability to be more vulnerable or to create more safety. And I think it's beyond words how important and how much growth you will have if you find those spaces and spend more time in those spaces.
Yeah. And I love that you talked about like not judging that part of you that couldn't take the embrace, because the first module in my women's program is radical self-love, because I want the foundation for every module after to be coming from radical self-love, because so many of us purchase a program and enter into a program out of like really another form of self-hatred or self-rejection, because we're trying to fix something and we're judging a part of ourselves that like we think needs to be healed. But that doesn't actually ever heal it, because it's just that vicious cycle, right? But like, if we're embracing it with love and we're holding it with love and we're holding it with compassion, like you said, that's when it actually can rest and transform. And the other part that I wanted to pull on was that is also what happened for me. It was an ayahuasca ceremony. I was in the first safe, somewhat conscious relationship I'd ever been in. And I couldn't be present with him in the bedroom. Like I couldn't even look him in the eyes, but he was the first person who wanted me to. He was the first person that cared about that and that cared about my pleasure. And so it was the first opportunity that I had to realize I couldn't. And I knew that like my three wounds in love were abandonment, betrayal, and worthiness. And I knew I knew where the abandonment and the worthiness came from. I didn't know where the betrayal came from. I thought maybe my birth dad was in and out of prison. He always promised me that he wasn't going to go back, but he always did. And I went to an ayahuasca ceremony asking, can we go into each of these and really, like, I really want to uncover what they are so that I can heal them and be able to be present with this man who wanted me, to meet him. And it was the betrayal cup where the sexual trauma came up. And I remember seeing what happened to me at 12 years old. And I remember a part of my soul, it like showed a part of my soul leaving my body in order to survive. And it, like the Impala that, Levine talks about, Peter Levine. And, I used to hold so much shame around the fact that I went into freeze mode during that trauma. And it was the first time that I actually felt proud of myself because it's how I survived it. But in that ayahuasca ceremony, that part of my soul that left my body re-entered. And I remember it was the first time that I felt like I was actually in my body. And I remember thinking, like, I've only ever felt the way that I've felt up until now. Like, what is life going to feel like now feeling, this fragmented part, like reintegrated. And so it's similar to what you said. And I know that you've brought that up, that experience where you felt this hope and this like different type of wholeness, you've related that to your poem Running. And you talk about how you can already feel what's possible for you in partnership and how even if others call you idealistic or whatever else, you're going to run towards that. And I have always held that as my truth as well. And I recently had a meeting with this woman who's like a mentor and very, very intuitive. And she said, I wrote down my note from this. She said, "You've carried since birth an idealization of what it would look like to be in deep, intimate union. This idealization is in the core of your being, and it is not that you're unrealistic. It's that you understand what's possible, what life could look like, what is possible because you are such an old soul of higher dimensions, which is the way of life there, this union. So you know through experience, this is what's possible because it's your template. Trust your template. It's from ancient experience." And that removes so much shame for me because it did feel a bit idealistic before, so I'd love to just, if you could share about that inner knowing, what that's been like for you and your dating process, because there's two things there. One is that like, you're the type of man I feel that most women would see and be like, that's what I want a man to say to me. And so naturally they're going to actually probably want to date you. Right. And they're going to be coming from that place of like, especially women who probably love words of affirmation, right? And so like, how has that been like in your dating process? And it's interesting because when you hold that as your template, it can in a way feel really lonely in the dating process to hold in a dating culture that's just now starting to remember it. And it's also oddly not lonely at all because it's almost like you always feel that partner with you in a way that it's kind of, you just carry. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Absolutely. Okay. this is really tied in also to a lot of the self-doubt and the self-judgment and the journey that I've been on in this way because I have often questioned whether my idealization, if we're going to call it that, of love and relationship is a impediment to what's actually like a grounded, real relationship. Mm-hmm. If basically I over-romanticize so much that I am never going to meet the person who could ever live up to this unrealistic expectation, right? Mm-hmm. And I've sat with that a lot. And I actually received, similar to you, I had a reading while I was in Egypt, actually outside of the Black Pyramid. And this channel, she was sharing with me, because I was explaining about this, I'd just gone through two back-to-back Iboga journeys and then flown from those to Egypt. So I was just in this dissolved space. And she said to me, this feeling that you have is not unrealistic. This feeling is actually been implanted. Like you came here with this thing to help you find your way to it, because mm-hmm. it is a, I don't really like this word, but I'm going to use it anyway, cause I can't think of a better one, but new earth, right? Like mm-hmm. it is a new earth blueprint of relationship. There is the way that relationships have been. And if you look around at society right now, we are in a redefining of what it means to be in relationship as masculine and feminine energetics on this planet. I could talk at length about that topic, but in this redefining of what it means to be in relationship between men, women, men, men, but just the alpha, omega, yin, yang, masculine, feminine energetics on the planet, to be redefining that, we need reference points for possibility. And I think that the artists, the poets, the songwriters, the painters, it's in the heart of art that we find the blueprint for possibility. The artists don't make it up. We feel it. My poem Running or Crazy Love or these poems that I've written are not coming from a ChatGPT prompt. They're coming from something I feel so deeply in my being that I know no other way to express it than in art, because trying to put words to it doesn't do it justice. And so it makes dating a tricky experience, I think, because I'm comparing what is in the moment to what I know I feel as being possible, and trying to find the balance of recognizing that what's possible is also something that's built. You don't arrive at that place. You build to that place. Mm-hmm. And so I combine my feeling of love that I know to be possible also with a successful 10-year relationship under my belt of what it actually looks like in a grounded way to have a relationship work consciously for 10 years. And there is a lot of work that goes into that. And I think to find that balance is ultimately very tricky. And to speak openly about it creates a lot of women project on me perfection in a lot of ways. Like, oh, this is exactly the thing that blah, blah, blah. And they don't even know me. So it's not grounded at all in any kind of reality. And I'll never be able to fulfill that, but I need to make sure I'm not doing the same thing to them. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. It's tricky. I'll put it that way. I don't know if that answered your question, but it gives you some insight into how I view it.
Yeah. It's funny because I wonder, like, what is something you'd share that would remove you from that pedestal that they have, you know, like, and like just something that it's like, so freaking like, oh my God, you know, like my show is very vulnerable and I'm very open when I have a panic attack or like, I struggled with an eating disorder that was so bad that I pooped my pants in the airport, like things like that, that I'll share that it's like that women probably thought that like I had this body confidence and I'll share that to where it's like, take me off of that. Like, because that's not what it's like, you know? And, what's the other thing you said? That it's built. I had on Alison Armstrong and she talked about like slow and steady is what's sustainable. Like if you enter in and it's like, not that sometimes we don't meet someone and we just have this like inner knowing, but like, I know for me, I was done with the like instant fireworks and the like, I've been with you in every life, you know, like I was done with it because it always, what I found is like that intensity, it didn't feel good to my nervous system. And it actually like, that was also where the conflict ended up being a bit, feeling more like a trauma bond. Like, and so I remember saying like, I'm done with that. Like I'm coming, I want peace and I want slow and steady and I want it to feel like a mountain and a river, you know, is that funny?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because in my last sort of exploration with a woman, she said she was nervous because she said, you have this crazy way of loving. You love in a very intense, crazy way. And she said, I want slow love. And
it can be both though.
Well, yes, she just said she wants slow love. And I said, I took out my journal and I wrote, she says she wants slow love. What the fuck is that? And I wrote, give me crazy love. And that line, give me crazy love. I immediately, as soon as I wrote it, went, ooh, that's a poem. And I went to my poetry journal and I wrote this poem that starts, give me crazy love. Give me phone calls that only end because we've fallen asleep and text messages that read like romance novels. I want to be met by someone who's willing to meet me in the deep end, diving headfirst into all of the places our friends find crazy. I want crazy love. And it's this long poem that goes in this really interesting direction because I use poetry oftentimes to explore what I'm actually feeling. And that was my exploration about love. And there's a line towards the end that I think is really valuable, which is, when you rejoin the angels through the gates of heaven, you will not share about the lives in which you played it safe or the risks you didn't take. And I really believe that. I believe that I'm here to live as fully as I can. And I think that at a certain point in my life, that looked unhealthy. It looked like trauma bonding. It looked like if it doesn't feel like fireworks, there's something off. And I think I'm at a point in my life now where crazy love and what that means to me has taken a different form. But for sure, what I know is that there is an undeniable sense of magnetism. Like, this is my person. And I feel that at such a deep level. It feels safe and warm and nourishing and soft, right? It's from the poem as well. And I also think that the other aspect to this is I have never prioritized peace as much as I do now. To me,
same.
My relationships, ideally one, like my relationship, whenever that my life is, it brings a sense of ease and peace to my life and my nervous system that I've just never even felt before. Because I believe that healing happens in direct correlation to how safe we feel. We don't really need to do all that much. If our nervous system feels safe, it will relax in a way it's never relaxed before. And in that, you will heal. And so if I can find that person where I feel safer, and not just like mentally because they check these boxes, but my actual nervous system unconsciously feels a sense of safety at a level I've never known, the growth, the healing, the expansion that will be possible is beyond what I can even comprehend. And so that peace is now a major priority for me and something that I think I'll just feel because it's a nervous system thing.
Thank you for listening to part one of Adam Roa. Stay tuned next time for part two.
Good health starts with seeing the whole picture and everyone in it. It's why Rutgers Health has dedicated billions of dollars in research to solve some of the greatest challenges and address inequities. From prenatal care to childhood illness to cardiovascular disease, we're leading the research that's improving lives. Rutgers Health, because all people deserve good health.